But what I discovered is that there is a very big grassroots effort now within Nepal, especially starting with the younger generations who are, they're seeing a change in their perspectives on elephant use. And they want to see this elephant back safari go away. They want to see elephants stay and be put into chain-free enclosures, maybe into larger sanctuaries where they can wander and have people be allowed to come and look at these elephants, but not interact with them.
And welcome to episode 18 of the Anthrozoology Podcast. My name's Sarah, and I'm a PhD student looking at shark-human interactions.
Hi, I'm Chris, and I'm also a PhD researcher with the University of Exeter, and my research looks at cat-human relations and discourses surrounding free-roaming urban cats. And today, our special guest is our very own co-host, Dr. Michelle Sadlowski. So Michelle has been active in conservation and education for decades, but switched her focus to pachyderms, that's elephants, in 2012 during following a trip to Nepal. And her research focuses on how on the interplay between local communities, NGOs, ecotourists, and other than human animals and their impacts on conservation efforts and captive elephant welfare. So thank you, Michelle. And maybe you can start by summarizing your research, your field work in Nepal.
Sure, thank you. So I actually first went to Nepal to study orphaned greater one horn rhinos and sort of look at the way in which we conserve endangered species and how we return them to the wild. What happened, however, when I was there is I started spending some time in the elephant stables and started to realize that captive elephants in Nepal live a very different life than their conspecifics in other countries. They face a lot of greater welfare challenges. They have a lot of different management systems. And I noticed also that the NGOs that were active in the area, both international and local NGOs, had a really big input on the treatment of elephants in the area. So that's what really got me interested. So I started to go back and forth to Nepal and watch the ways that humans and elephants interacted, watch the ways in which conservation of wild elephants and endangered species in elephant stables differed, and the ways in which NGOs trying to make improvements in elephant well-being really impacted how mahouts and owners and community members treated their elephants.
So why Nepal in the first place? How did you come across Nepal as a place to visit and elephants to look at and rhinos to look at?
That's a good question. I had a friend who was looking for a place where you could have rhinoceros and elephants. And Nepal is one of the few places, of course, where you can find both in one place. And so we went there first as a travel group. I wanted to get to know a different country. And just sort of fell in love with Nepal and the beauty of Nepal and the people of Nepal. And I really got connected in with the community and I was hooked. So I started going back about every 18 months for 3 or 4 months at a time. So when it came time to do my PhD work, it seemed a natural place to focus.
So you said you first visited as a tourist yourself. So I guess how can someone be an ethical tourist when other than human animals are involved? For example, I guess elephant rides are still offered in the area you visit.
That's a really good question. And I think even as someone who's been involved in conservation for a long time, I was still very uneducated as to how animals in tourism venues are treated. And the first time I went to Nepal, I went with a group that did decide to ride elephants. And it seemed like a logical idea to someone who grew up in Colorado like it did, seeing lots of horseback riding, lots of human-animal interactions. And it wasn't until I started to really think about the fact that these were not only endangered species, but these are highly intelligent, highly social beings. And the fact that they were being kept and managed in ways that went against their natural behavior really started to make me think a little bit harder about all animals in tourism venues. So that's really what keyed me into the desire to focus on the captive working elephants of Nepal. As far as being an ethical tourist goes, there's really no way, unless you visit a venue that doesn't allow any sort of contact with wildlife, even captive wildlife. And that's really difficult because people are drawn to especially large charismatic mega herbivores. And there is this desire to become a part of their life, but really to allow them to have the most agency possible and have best life that they can, they need to be able to not be around human tourists. So my advice to anyone looking to take any kind of a animal-based tourism trip is to just make sure that the venue you're at doesn't allow any sort of interaction between tourists and other animals.
How do you navigate the balance between elephants needing tourism so they have some welfare and care, but at the same time, tourism creating problems for their welfare and care?
It's tricky. I mean, Nepal is highly tourism-based. You know, there's about 1 million Nepalese people that rely on tourism for their survival. So tourism has become big business through a lot of the world's poorest countries. It's one of the ways that they can survive. So when we're talking about tourism, we have to be really careful too, that we're not negatively impacting the only way that a lot of communities can get by. So the interesting thing about tourism is in Nepal is that if you talk to a lot of elephant owners, they will tell you that elephant tourism has been a big part of Nepalese history for thousands of years. Well, it's true that elephants have been used in Nepal for thousands of years in war efforts and in forestry efforts. What is not true is that they've been used in tourism for a long time. So elephant back safari, which is the process of putting a howdah on an elephant's back, a riding platform, filling it with tourists and taking them on jungle rides, only started in the mid to late 1960s. So it's a fairly new practice. The thing is, it was an excellent way to get tourists into the Chitwan area, which was largely undiscovered at that point, right? There weren't a lot of international tourists visiting the area. So elephants were a great way to get people to come in. But elephants are quite expensive and you can't remove them from the wild in Nepal. So what started happening is elephants would be purchased or leased from India and brought into Nepal. Because elephants eat so much and they require a lot of care, and they typically require two elephant drivers per elephant, it is very expensive to keep them. So the elephant owners have tried to come up with a way to continue making not only enough money to feed and care for their elephants, but enough money to make a big profit on the elephants. And they've been very successful on doing that. So it is kind of a balance. You know, the owners tend to think that they want to make as much money from the elephant as they can. So sometimes these elephants are giving up to 9 rides a day, especially during festival seasons. The rides can be an hour and a half through the jungle. So a lot of times the elephants go out with a load of people, come right back, load up new people, go back out into the jungle. So they might be spending 9 hours in the heavy wooden howdah, 6 guests on their back, and not getting much rest in between. So they suffer a lot of challenges from this constant walking with the howdah on their back, from the strapping, a lot of wounds. And then they also face challenges because the safety of the tourists is important, because if tourists get injured, no one will come ride elephants. So there's this need to control the elephant for the safety of the tourists. And that means that further repressing the natural behaviors of the elephant as you go through the jungle, meaning not letting them browse as they're walking, not letting them explore scents that they might want to, not letting them interact with their conspecifics, not letting them be social. So there is this need to to sort of dominate the elephant for tourist safety, which creates even more problems.
So if all elephant tourism would be stopped in Nepal, what would happen to the elephants?
So see, there's the problem. So we've brought these elephants into Nepal. And one of the unique characteristics of Nepal is that the elephants there face a lot of challenges, but they don't face the same kinds of challenges they might face in other countries. So we would like to keep the working elephants in Nepal because a lot of these elephants, as they get sent back to India, end up as rental or beggar elephants, which means they're taken from town to town. They serve at weddings. They might end up as a temple elephant, which is standing in one place for 8-9 hours a day and not being allowed to move. They might end up as a street beggar, walking kilometers and kilometers and kilometers in the hot sun, begging for food. So the situation is worse for them if they leave Nepal. So ideally, we would like them to stay in Nepal. The challenge then becomes, because it is so expensive to feed and maintain an elephant, what do we do? There's also the challenge for mahouts, who are typically undereducated individuals. They don't have a lot of other job options. And if elephant tourism suddenly dries up, we have an entire group of already marginalized people who are then out of work and can't feed their families. So what we're trying to do right now is find a way to improve elephant welfare in small steps, in ways that won't be terribly expensive, and in ways that won't make the lives of mahouts harder, because mahouts are paid way less than the lowest level of civil servant in Nepal, and find a way that owners can still make enough money to feed these elephants without having to rely on elephant back safari. The trick is, it's really hard to convince people who are making large sums of money to change their operating practices, especially when you're in a country that has very different perspectives on elephant use than maybe people in the West do. So it's a very slow process. So in the beginning, I was concerned about being an advocate for elephants. I was concerned about talking to owners about stopping elephant safari. But what I discovered is that there is a very big grassroots effort now within Nepal, especially starting with the younger generations, who are, they're seeing a change in their perspectives on elephant use. And they want to see this elephant back safari go away. They want to see elephants stay and be put into chain-free enclosures, maybe into larger sanctuaries where they can wander, and have people be allowed to come and look at these elephants, but not interact with them. So the tricky thing is trying to balance the needs of the community, the desires of the community, with the need for the elephant owners to continue to make money to support the elephants. Also find a way that the elephants get to be considered as equally important and have a way to live their lives where they get to express their own agency and live in social groups and have a much better life. So it's a tricky balance, but it's a very slow process, but good things are happening over there.
You kind of already answered my question, but I'm was thinking that how you as an outsider, so sort of a white Western woman coming in, how can you balance that advocating for both the elephants and the humans who are the marginalized groups? So you say it's the owners are making all the money, but the elephants and the other humans who are looking after these elephants are not so much benefiting from that. The trickle down is not happening, even if it is better than if it was completely abolished. So I was wondering how you how you can navigate the challenges of coming in as an outsider and advocating for both elephants and humans.
That's an excellent question. And again, a part of that is based on how unique Nepal is. Nepal is very friendly to tourists. They love tourists. They realize that a lot of the income relies on tourists. So they're very open to foreigners, which is fantastic. As a white middle-aged woman, I did run into some issues with some of the higher caste men who serve in many of the governmental organizations over there. Nepal is very much a caste-based system. So it is high caste men who run government agencies, high caste men who serve in the National Trust for Nature Conservation, which is sort of like their wildlife division. So there was some pushback there with some of those men, but that was more based on the fact that I was a female, as opposed to the fact that I was a Westerner. Westerners and tourists are in a unique position in Nepal because they're essentially casteless, which means that we are free to interact with people that wouldn't impact our own standing. So whereas if I'm a high caste Nepali person, I might not want to interact with a low caste Nepali person for fear of it damaging my own standing. Because tourists are casteless, they are able to move within these groups more easily, which is fantastic. It also really helped that I went about this from what I like to call a relational standpoint. When I first got to Nepal, I didn't launch into trying to look at the social system there. I didn't try to begin with studies. What I started with is making relationships. I made friends. I talked to everybody that I could talk to. I hung out with people, had a lot of tea, I ate a lot of cookies, and I just got to know people before I tried to get any research done. And that really helped me when I decided to go back and do my work within Nepal. So it was very nice that I could switch between castes, but I did have to be careful too, because in my view, everyone is equal and I treat everyone equally. And in seeing me do that, there was some confusion sometimes among the higher caste men who really felt like I should be talking down to my house and thought that I should not be as willing to spend time with the Mahouts as I was. But for me, the Mahouts are the carriers of the knowledge. They're the ones that are really responsible for the elephant health and welfare. They're the ones that are doing the hard work up to 17 hours a day. And I really wanted to spend time with them and get to know them. So one of the ways that I went about doing that is by also bringing in the same caste people. So if I needed to work with some Mahouts that maybe didn't speak English or didn't even speak Nepali, they might speak a tribal language, I would bring in a translator from the same caste to try to sort of avoid some of those, you know, power imbalances in our communication. But for the most part, the Mahouts are very open to sharing their stories and very open to sharing the way that they care for elephants. So it was fantastic.
So talking about power imbalances, I wonder how that relates to communicating with elephants, because in your studies, you talk about interactions with elephants, but they're captive. They can't sort of turn around and say, no, I don't want to talk to you. So how do you navigate, I guess, sort of seeking consent from your elephants? Do you want to share a little bit? I know you've published on this, so I guess that's why I'm asking.
I did. I wrote a paper about asking consent from elephants because it is tricky. When I went through the ethics process and I had to think so carefully about these power imbalances with human beings, the thing that I wasn't asked to consider was those power imbalances between captive wildlife, because all of these elephants are stuck. No, they can't break off from the encounter. They can't just wander away from their stable at will. They can't leave the safari. Pretty much every aspect of their life is controlled. And so I started thinking through how I might approach another captive population, like prisoners. Okay, if I wanted to approach prisoners, how would I go about doing that? Understanding that I can leave at any time and they can't. So I tried to be more sensitive to that. When that didn't prove to be too good of a combination in my head, I started to think of them more as sort of indentured servants or people who are stuck in a job that they didn't choose, stuck in a home that they didn't choose, you know, maybe by virtue of their birth or their position, they're stuck in a dead-end job, you know, just like a human would be. What I had to consider was how I approached the mahouts, and that helped me get to how I should approach the elephants. So I wouldn't just walk into someone's home and expect that they want to talk to me, and I wouldn't just walk into someone's personal space. So what I started to do is, as I got closer to the stables, I would try to make noise and talk to whoever I ran into so that my voice would be heard. I know that the elephants can smell me at a great distance and probably recognize my scent. I tried to keep my vocalizations at a different pitch because elephants are very sensitive to the pitch of vocalizations of their conspecifics and of humans. And then I tried to just spend some time there. Just like I wouldn't wander into somebody's house and start picking up all of their personal belongings and looking at them, I just sort of hung out in the stable and waited for the elephant to approach me or to smell me or attempt to interact with me. If they try to interact with me, I let them sniff me. If they invited further contact, they either stepped toward me or tried to pull me toward them, I would take a step closer. I tried to really wait and read their cues. And of course, that's impossible if you don't know a lot about the biology of the species that you're studying. And this is one of the issues that I find with researchers, especially young researchers, is that a lot of people want to go off and study primates or, you know, study pachyderms, and they don't really have that necessary biological background and behavioral background to truly understand what this species is telling you. And we forget with humans, because we assume humans are all the same, but of course they're not. You wouldn't go to a country to research another culture without finding out about that culture first. And yet people tend to just throw themselves in with other than human animals and expect that they will be able to understand them without doing the background. So it took a long time. I've been working with pachyderms, you know, on a voluntary basis and then also on a research basis for years. And it was getting to know what different vocalizations mean, getting to know what different movements mean, getting to know, you know, their preferences and desires and read their the sounds that they make, because sometimes happy grumbles and angry grumbles sound very similar. And sometimes hungry squeaks and scared squeaks sound very similar. So it was all getting to know my participants that helped me start to understand. And for the most part, most elephants offered me a scent to enter into their space. But I did try to make sure that I wasn't just misreading habituation to humans or misreading their desire for a treat. You know, maybe they were just hoping I had a treat. And the relationships with each of the elephants did change as time went on. You know, there were elephants that would get really excited to see me and invite me in. And there were elephants that, you know, wanted to be more independent. And so I just left them alone. And there was one male elephant that absolutely refused to have me anywhere near him. So I stayed quite far away from him as much as possible to keep him calm.
I think that you come up with an interesting point there, and I was going to ask about it, but you went on to it, is that a lot of the research that we read talks about species as a homogeneous mass in many ways, and not as animals as individuals, which is very, is often not the case when we're studying humans. We consider a human participant each has their own personality, et cetera, et cetera. But you came on, I was going to ask you about if there was an elephant that had decided not to to allow, you know, you any participation. Did that elephant allow anybody else any participation? Was it just you? Was it like an individual to individual relationship difference, or was he the same with other humans as well?
He's very much the same with other humans. He is in a very bad living situation. He was purchased as a young male, and he went through must, which is the period of hormonal spiking that male elephants get when they're ready to mate, and they essentially sort of lose their mind, right? They become very unpredictable and aggressive. And because he was uncontrollable and his owner was inexperienced, he ended up having to be confined for a very long time. And so he just does not like having a lot of people around. So he allows his mahout, he's only got one mahout now, to be in the area with him and cleaning and feeding. But beyond his mahout, he really just doesn't want other people around. And luckily his owner has moved him to a spot further away from town. So he is around many fewer people now. But he's still rather uncomfortable, you know, in his situation. And he really doesn't have any agency over his life. So I sort of equate him to the prisoner in solitary that is so used to being alone. And anytime somebody comes near him, it's not for a good reason. So he starts to become aggressive and unhappy. So we're working on ways to get him into a different facility. Work on supporting this owner. This owner is one that is really trying to make a difference for his elephants, but because finances are so tight, especially after COVID, he's having a lot of difficulty. So we're trying to find him some ways to improve the life of this elephant. But back to your personalities question. I mean, that's another thing. Yeah, we tend to look at populations as researchers, especially as biologists. And, you know, we look at elephants. We don't look at an elephant. And I found that each of my participants was so very, very different that the approach to each elephant, you know, the favorite treat, the welcoming method was very different. Some elephants approach you in a different way. Some elephants want a different part of their body touched. Some elephants have body parts they don't want touched. Some like sound. Some don't like sound. So I really looked at each of my participants as an individual with their own personality and their own wants and desires and friendships, as opposed to just this set of captive elephants as a group.
You make me think a lot about liminality. I mean, these elephants are taking from birth or from non-captive situations. And then they go through this threshold of becoming a tourist elephant. I'm guessing that some leave that space of becoming a tourist elephant and go on to move somewhere else. But I'm wondering how you feel about how the elephants feel how you approach your research in terms of how elephants may feel about something. That they may not have realized they've gone from one space into another and not realizing they can't escape that space. I'm wondering if that male elephant has realized this is it, this is his life, and he's resisting, he's protesting, he's saying, this is not the agency I choose. So what do you feel about things like that?
I think that's very true. And I think it's very clear, and the house and the owners will say this too, that when elephants are given the opportunity to get away and go off into the jungle, they do. And the mahouts will tell you that that is their desire for their elephants, is to have more freedom, to be able to express their own agency, to go off when they want to and come back when they want to. And I think that is a lot of it, that you get this learned helplessness when you're in a situation that you have no agency and you just stop trying. And I think a lot of the elephants who are sick and injured and old, which is quite a few of them, end up giving up. And there have been some that have been so severely debilitated because they've had no agency in their life that they have simply stopped trying. They'll be approached by strangers. They won't open their eyes. They'll suck their trunk. They will stand completely still, which, if you've ever watched elephants, you know, elephants are perpetual motion machines. Something is always moving, a tail or a foot or an ear or the trunk. Very rarely do they stand still. And you will have a few elephants that are just statues. And the trunk sucking is happening. And there's some very concerning characteristics that happen, much like prisoners or enslaved people who have no control over their lives. They do give up. And a lot of times, well, prior to COVID, those elephants were sent back to India. Luckily, during COVID, Nepal has decided to enforce the CITES agreement and close the border so that the elephants can no longer pass back and forth across the border, which is fantastic. That means that now we finally have a chance to make life better for the elephants that are in Nepal without the worry of as soon as one gets sick or injured, it gets shipped off to India to a much worse life. So we also have the chance now, these elephants that I've been working with for the last 7-8 years are now a steady population. So we can track the health of each individual elephant over a period of time instead of seeing them for 2 years and having them shipped off to India and then a different one comes. And yeah, so we actually have a chance now to really improve the welfare of the entire population within Nepal, which is fantastic.
Wasn't the very unfortunate circumstance, though, of an elephant being caught in a liminal space? You're writing a paper about it at the moment?
Yes. Elephants and the hawks both are stuck in very liminal spaces. So the fact that you've got an endangered species in a range state, so a place where they're found normally, you've got this endangered species in the wild, which is just fiercely protected, right? We must protect these wild elephants because there's fewer than 140 wild elephants left in Nepal, right? Oh, we have to protect these elephants, give them protected spaces, keep them away from humans. Then we have the exact same species living in a stable and being ridden and fed food that's inappropriate for it, and taking away its agency. And so they're stuck in this really bizarre place that we realize how important they are, and the Nepalese realize how important they are, and yet they're kept in the stable and mistreated. So they're caught in this very odd place. They're also seen as the embodiment of the god Ganesh, right? So when they pass away, they are revered, and people will come and place flowers and touch the elephant because it's so important to them. And older people will come to see the captive elephant and give blessings to the captive elephant. So it's this strange area that they live in between, you know, enslaved creature and fiercely protected wild animal. And then we have the Mahouts, who are also in this weird spot that they're in charge of taking care of these embodiments of gods. They're in charge of making huge amounts of money for their owners. They're the ones that carry this traditional knowledge from the last thousands of years. And yet they're viewed by society as very low caste. They're uneducated. They're a lot of times considered gamblers or drunkards. You know, they're seen as a really low group of people. So again, they're stuck in the middle between this two different statuses. And then at the same time, they're treated badly by society, and yet they're in charge of tourist safety, right? And so you've got all these tourists who are getting on an elephant, knowing nothing about elephants and how dangerous this situation is. The elephant's been through a breaking process. The elephant is probably managed with dominance management. So the elephant could at some point decide to express its agency, right? So you've got this mistreated, underpaid human being in charge of keeping all of these tourists safe. So it is really strange. It's a strange situation. And then you have tourists too that are also liminal because they are excited about animals. They want to see animals in the wild. They want to experience nature. And then they get on the back of an endangered species who's kept captive to wander off into the jungle to go see other species in the wild. So yeah, this whole caught up in this liminality is such a good way to look at the situation.
So going back to the Mahout elephant relationship, I have a couple of questions there. So I do see some parallels with my case studies of cat human dyads and potentially this relationship and the intersubjectivity of meaning making. So and you mentioned that a lot of behavioral studies, they take a species-wide generalization and a particular behavior or stance means a particular thing. But I found cat-human relations, a lot of communication is built within the relationship. So they learn to understand each other with unique signals. And the person who lives with a cat knows a cat perhaps much better than an expert behaviorist watching from the outside. So yeah, that was sort of my first part of the question. The other, I guess, are related is I noticed from my experience cat sitting is a cat will behave very differently when their person's there to when I go in without them. And it's like, so I was wondering how much of a role the mahouts played in translating what the elephant was trying to tell you. And also, what was the status of those relationships? Were they always, obviously they're not comparable to a human and a companion animal relationship because they're both very much under the control of the owner, right? Both parties. And are they always healthy relationships, or is the mahout perhaps taking out resentment on the elephant? Or sorry, they're two kind of related but different questions there. But I wonder, yes, if you could share a little bit about that.
It is complex. There's a lot of different ways to look at mahout relationships. And in the past, the job of mahout was very much a familial job. So you would come from a line of mahouts, you would grow up around elephants. So you had a lot of that embodied knowledge of elephant behavior from watching it from the time you were young. You would then learn how to work with the elephant. And you had a lot different bond in the past. Now what has happened is, because it is not a well-paying job, a lot of those familial lines of mahouts have moved on to other jobs, or adults don't want their kids going into this job because it doesn't pay well. So they've encouraged them to go different ways. So what happens now is that you've got this group of young men that doesn't have any education and doesn't have any other job prospects. And so they come to elephant care later in their life. Because they don't have that embodied knowledge, they don't speak elephant, as it were. So instead of building that relationship, a lot of times they go straight to the dominance training, and they try to make the elephant submit. They try to get a higher social standing than the elephant, which sometimes works because a lot of these elephants are, you know, emotionally damaged. So that's one of the first issues, is that this relationship has changed. The second issue is that there's been a lot of romanticizing of the relationship in anthropology in the past. This mahout elephant relationship has been viewed as a long-standing healthy relationship or quality relationship, because there's been a lot of fear of speaking out against any kind of a human animal relationship that's negative, out of fear of being called a neocolonialist or a racist. Or so a lot of anthropologists have sort of just romanticized this elephant human relationship. In reality, the better way to look at it is probably as two employees that work for a not so great boss. Right. And both employees are treated kind of badly. They're not paid very well. They don't have good working conditions. And so they're struggling to see who can be in charge of that relationship. They live together. They work together. They can't get away from each other. Sometimes they're going to become friends, right? You'll have some really close relationships. They're like family members. But then you'll have other ones that are really in conflict, that they just don't like each other, or they've worked together to the point where they're like old married spouses that just don't get along anymore. So you really have the spectrum between the young men who grew up with elephants and have a different sort of perspective to these newer mahouts that don't really speak elephant. And then you also have ones that are drawn to elephants because of the size and the desire to dominate, because when you are a low caste person without a lot of options, you're part of a marginalized community, you also have that learned helplessness. You feel like you have no control over your life. One way you can get control over your life is to feel like you're in control of another being. And we see this in our treatment of all kinds of companion animals as well. We see this in our treatment of other employees. You know, everybody works with a bully, right? That bully is trying to get some control over their life. So we also see that type of a relationship, which can be alarming. And then we also see sort of some more parental relationships, some older mahouts that have worked with the elephant for so long, they kind of see it as a younger family member. They get irritated sometimes, they'll yell at the elephant, but in general, it's a bond that's been around for decades. that's very strong. But the thing to consider here is that we also have to avoid playing the happy enslaved person game. And that's that same misrepresentation of, oh, enslaved people were happy. You know, they sang songs, they loved their owners. They, you know, we sort of painted this picture of happy times, especially in the American South. We have to be careful not to paint that same picture, because even though the elephants may be used to being in this situation, that doesn't necessarily mean they're enjoying the situation, right? So even if they are happy that day, that doesn't necessarily mean that this is the life that they would choose. So we have to be careful not to fall down that trap of saying, well, if this elephant looks healthy and it's happy today, it must be in a good situation. That just isn't the reality.
So how is Nepal different from the other range states then, Michelle?
That's a really good question. So a lot of people expect that because most of the research in elephants happens in places like Thailand or India, people expect that all of the range states must be very similar in how they take care of elephants. And that's simply not the case. So in Thailand, for example, a lot of elephants live in camp situations. They live at least where they have visual or olfactory contact with one another. Sometimes they're housed together, but they're in bigger facilities where more elephants live. So they have a few more opportunities for socialization, even if it isn't ideal. In Nepal, most of these elephants are housed in very small open-walled stables behind hotels, very close to town where it's quite loud. Elephants that are housed in pairs are housed where they cannot touch each other. So they're lacking that tactile contact, which they love. Elephants are one big tactile organ. Their whole body is tactile. And so that's really hard for them. So yeah, so that's one of the biggest characteristics, is that they don't live in groups with groups of mahouts and groups of elephants and veterinary care. Instead, they live alone in very small, inappropriate shelters behind hotels, on inappropriate substrate, typically concrete or hard surfaces, which are not great for their feet and joints. They don't have three mahouts per elephant or rotating mahouts. They have one or two mahouts. And then the biggest difference is that a lot of range areas have the ability to go off into the forest for grazing, or have food brought in for grazing, or even have a semi-wild existence where at night they can go off into the jungle and meet with wild conspecifics and graze. In Nepal, normally about 70% of the food is provisioned. Over COVID, it went up to about 95% of the food is provisioned, which means brought into the stable and served to the elephant. In Nepal, the cheapest, easiest to store food is rice. Rice is not elephant food. It has not, it's not found where elephants live normally. they do seek, wild elephants do seek out rice as a cultivated crop as they're passing through areas. They will eat rice, but it's not a normal elephant food, and it's not nutritionally valuable for them. What it is cheap, easy to store, and it makes them feel full. Okay, so what elephants in Nepal are given are kuchis, which are rice and molasses and salt, wrapped up inside dry grass and then stuffed into their mouth. And most of the elephants don't want to eat the kuchis because the grass is dry. They don't taste very good. So what's happening is they're being forced to eat things that they don't like. And when they don't eat them, the mahouts will yell at them or smack them to try to get them to eat, because it is the mahout's job to make sure the elephant eats. So that's probably the biggest issue, is that there's just nowhere for these elephants to properly forage or graze. In the wild, they would eat 100 different plants, and they just don't get that in captivity. So we have a lot of malnourished elephants, a lot of elephants that don't get to express variety in their foods. They may never get a food that they actually like. So it is pretty tricky to have healthy elephants in Nepal. And it's also tricky when we fall into that trap of thinking that because some elephants in Thailand in a certain situation may have some positive welfare, or at least not have any worse welfare maybe wild elephants, maybe they have the same stress levels. Some studies have shown that. But in Nepal, that is not the case because they are in a vastly different situation. So we have to avoid that generalization.
So it seems that these elephants are in a constant state of abuse then, and they are remaining there because if they got no option, they don't have a better option to leave. And even the remaining in Nepal situation is constant abuse. Even though people are trying to not abuse them, their situation is so dire, they're still abused.
Well, sadly, for a lot of cases, that's true. So dominance management happens after the crush, which is it's a very, very ritualistic ceremony, which also involves a lot of great care and a lot of violence. But it does result in a lot of emotional damage for an elephant. And to maintain that treatment, you have to maintain dominance over the elephant. Now, there have been some attempts to introduce operant conditioning, but because it is such a novel concept throughout Asia, it's not widely embraced. So there have been attempts to introduce that with some limited success. There are elephants that are just what their mahouts will call good elephants. They listen very well, they follow verbal commands, so they don't receive the same abuse as other elephants. But there are elephants that are constantly beaten, that have been stabbed. They are chained usually 24 hours a day if they're not on safari. So during COVID, a lot of elephants stood in one place for 24 hours a day, which is really bad for their joints and their feet. To maintain that control and to maintain tourist safety, yeah, they do have to be dominated. There is a lot of abuse. So what is the answer to that? Well, part of that is respecting mahouts, right? If we respect mahouts and respect the job that they're doing and start treating them like equal human beings, then what we see happen is a change in the way that elephants become treated. We see a change in perspective on that elephant. We see that when we start respecting mahouts and making sure they have healthcare and clothes and school for their children, they take more pride in their job. The relationship with the mahout and the elephant changes, and we have more positive relationships. So that's step one to ending this cycle. Step two is finding a way to work with owners. Some NGOs do not want to work with owners because they see owners as the enemy. But you cannot change anything in Nepal without working with the owners, right? And the owners culturally are good businessmen. They've got an asset. They're using that asset to provide for their family and to get a better standing in the community by making a lot of money, okay? So you can't go to this person who's a good businessman and is culturally accepted and say, you have to stop doing what you're doing, right? So we have to find a way to provide a different income for owners so that they can still make money off of their what they see as their commodities, right? So we have to stop vilifying owners from a Western perspective. We have to accept that they are good businessmen in Nepal. Okay, so that's step two. So then what do we need to do? We need to improve these stables so that we can improve elephant welfare in the short term while this community perspective is changing toward chain-free enclosures and toward contact-free venues. So we need to support positive tourism, going to see elephants that are in better situations. So if there is a chain-free place there, the one owner that has a chain-free facility, we need to funnel people to him so that he sees people will come. If elephants are treated better, people will come visit you, you will make more money, you can then treat your elephants even better. So we've got that side of things. So we have to deal with the mahouts, we have to deal with the owners, we have to deal with the stables. Then we have to deal with the hardest hurdle, and that is culture. Because Westerners, so people from the UK, people from the rest of Europe, people from the US, people from Australia, those people used to be the main consumers of elephant-back safari. They have now fallen down, right? They are disappearing because they no longer want to ride elephants. However, there's this rising middle class in China. There's a rising middle class in India. And there is a large group of people in Nepal that see nature differently see our use of nature differently, and it's very culturally acceptable to use wildlife in this way. There's no cognitive dissonance, right? It's really, they really want to ride these elephants. So because this is now going up, what the elephant owners are seeing is that, there is more of a push to ride elephants from Asian communities, while Western community riding elephants is falling. So now we're sort of butting heads with this people who really want to ride elephants and those cultural perspectives. So now we're in kind of a strange place, because I think as tourism rebounds, the tourism that's rebounding fastest in Nepal is that Asian tourism. So what I fear is that there will be so much money made that the elephant owners will stop the positive steps that they've made so far and try to capture this income. And the only way to change those perspectives is through education. And that's where these younger grassroots organizations are coming in. It's really the young people who are advertising about ethical lifestyles. They're advertising about elephant treatment. They're advertising about different ways of doing tourism. And they're encouraging people to visit ethical venues or to do things like taking a hike instead of taking a jeep ride or riding an elephant. So really it's now we're in this waiting stage where these grassroots organizations are taking hold and hopefully can make a big difference, because that needs to come from within. That can't come from without. It can't be a bunch of Westerners telling people in Nepal, this is how you have to do things, or telling people throughout Asia, this is how you have to do things. It has to come from within, or it's never going to be successful.
And so how can, everyday people help? I guess, how can our viewers help the elephants and communities in Nepal? Any ideas?
Well, there are a few ways. I mean, most importantly is to be an ethical traveler in general. And we all, of course, we all want to see exotic things. We all want to see new things, but we do need to be cognizant of the effect we're having on the environment, especially in biodiverse areas like Nepal. Okay, so if you want to go visit a protected area, please do bear in mind that your presence there is increasing consumption of things like meat, increasing use of infrastructure, increasing water use. So try to minimize those effects as much as you can. Maybe stay in a place that allows you to go plant trees. Maybe stay in a place that uses less water. Maybe stay in a place that is eco-friendly, an eco-friendly lodge, because you can find those in most countries. And then also just look at your behavior, you know, look at your desires and your consumption of the environment. You know, if you want to go into the jungle, do take a walk. Don't, with a guide, of course, don't take a jeep ride. Take a canoe down the river. Go see animals in their native habitat, keeping a good distance. If you're with a quality guide, that guide will keep you at a safe distance from those animals, so the animals don't get habituated and then leave the area or behave in ways that are dangerous for you. Don't ever embrace any sort of a tourism venue that you see any kind of abuse. Don't go to venues that allow you to touch or feed wildlife. And I think those are probably the keys. If you need advice, do your research. You know, check with people who are experts in the field. Check with tourism agencies. Check with on TripAdvisor. Just do your research before you enter an area and really know what you're getting into.
And what about these specific elephants? Can people do anything to help the elephants that you're working with in Chittagong?
They can. There's actually quite a few NGOs. There are some NGOs that are active in the area and have a permanent presence. I do have issues with parachute organizations that drop into an area and kind of stir up trouble or try to improve this or that and then leave. There are organizations that are involved in the Saraha area, which is where my field sites are. Probably the biggest one that I deal with is called Stand Up for Elephants. And they are working on education programs for the community. They are also a Nepali They're a Belgian registered NGO, and they also are a Nepali registered NGO, which means that they have an all Nepali board. They have a facility that is a chain-free facility for retired elephants. So that is a way that, they actually support mahouts. They have a mahout closet for mahouts that need different clothes, winter coats, stuff for their children. They provide education for mahouts and mahout families. They provide support for sick elephants. They provide veterinary support in the area. So organizations like that, you could find they're at su4e.org. And that's a good way. Another way, I have an informational website that's called internationalelephants.org. And you can find some of my publications there. I'm in the process of expanding that website so that there'll be a place that you can donate to specific causes if you want to. Say you want to bring in some dirt for an elephant, because having loose dirt is really important for an elephant's joints and their ability to lay down. There'll be an opportunity for you to support projects like that. I also just encourage you to reach out through the podcast. You can send me an email through internationalelephants.org or through the podcast. I can help assist you directing funds to organizations that will get funding to the elephants where they need it. And I'm also happy to give any kind of advice about traveling to range states or places that you can go see elephants, or places that here within the US that you could visit elephants that are in good situations. Yeah, I'm happy to do any of that.
So thank you very much for joining us today, Michelle. And I know you'll be joining us next time as the host rather than the interviewee. It's been great talking to you, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a great day.